Okay, hi everyone. Hope you enjoyed a few days break from this course. And before we get into today's lecture, let me just remind you that the first homework for this course is due tomorrow, so feel free to let me know if you have any questions on that. And if you need an extension, please just make sure you let me know before the deadline and tell me an alternative deadline that would work for you. So far in this course, we've been mostly focused on supervised learning, and we focused a lot on feed-forward neural networks, but we also saw some other algorithms for supervised learning, such as linear regression. And now we're going to switch gears and start talking about unsupervised learning. So I'm going to start by just kind of reminding you of the definition, which I think I maybe stated on the first day, but kind of remind you of what we mean by unsupervised learning. Give you some examples of classes of tasks that we can study with that. I'll talk to you, there's actually a relationship to supervised learning, so I'll kind of just show you that. And then most of the lecture today will be focused on a specific class of unsupervised learning tasks, which I'll kind of show you more generally, called dimensional reduction. So today, tomorrow, and tomorrow's tutorial will be on dimensional reduction. And today we'll specifically look at a method called principal component analysis. Does anyone have any questions and more general questions before we start? Okay, so unsupervised learning. So the main thing that's going to differentiate the class of unsupervised learning from supervised learning is that we're going to be considering data that doesn't have labels for all algorithms in this set. The goal of this set of methods would be to learn some kind of properties about the structure of data, but without known labels. Okay, so the notation we're going to use is just that my data set is some set of points x. You'll notice there's no y because there's no labels. And we're going to need to kind of think of two ways of indexing this data. So first is the number of components that my data has. So my data can have n components. And then, as we've seen many times in this course, of course, we need to train on a lot of data. So our data set, we're going to say, contains m points. So n components and m data points. So we're going to specifically look at two classes of unsupervised learning tasks. So the first one that we'll study is dimensional reduction. So that's going to be today, also next lecture, also tomorrow's tutorial, and also on the homework you'll look at a problem using this method. And the idea here is we often look at data that has a large number of components, so it's very high dimensional data. And what we try to do is represent this data in a lower dimension so that it's especially if we go down to two or three dimensions, it might be easier to visualize. And so what we want to do is effectively represent this data in a lower dimension by somehow identifying in a smart way the important features or important correlations in the data. So we'll say, in general, we might reduce the dimensionality from n to some new n prime. So if we go from n to n prime with n prime equals 2 or 3, then we can easily visualize. And of course, if n prime is bigger, you might be able to have some creative way of doing some projections to do some visualization in some way. But we're going to look at cases where we visualize to 2 or 3. And it'll be quite straightforward to visualize. Now, of course, there might be cases where, with the data you have and the algorithm that you choose to use to do this, it might not really help you to learn anything, or you might lose some features of your data. But in some cases, this can be very helpful. So we're going to see that in some cases, when we do this reduction, our data set will naturally form some clusters that you'll be able to see by eye, are kind of helping to group or distinguish the data. Okay, so let me show you an example, which is what we're going to look into in tomorrow's tutorial using one algorithm, and then in the two homework using another algorithm. Is, of course, it's going to be the Ising model. So we could consider feeding in a bunch of Ising model configurations, but without labels this time. So we've already studied the Ising model, but so far we've always given this ferromagnetic or paramagnetic label. But in this case, maybe we take configurations that are generated at many temperatures, but we don't tell the algorithm anything about the temperature or the phase. We still, with a good algorithm, might be able to form clusters. And we'll actually see you can even accomplish this if we go all the way down to 2D. So let me just kind of sketch what this might look like. So I would start with some high dimensional coordinates that have n components, but maybe I'll reduce to just 2. So these are my new coordinates that I might identify with an algorithm I haven't described yet, but imagine you can identify the important components here. What you might see is you might see something like this, that three phases kind of form. And upon further inspection, we're going to see cases where we can actually show, oh, it's forming these clusters. And then we can show that one of them is all paramagnetic points. One of them is all ferromagnetic points, but in the upstate. And one of them is all ferromagnetic, but in the downstate. So for now, I'm just giving you a quick overview of what dimensional reduction is. I'm going to talk about a few more general properties of unsupervised learning, and then we'll kind of dig into this type of task and an example of an algorithm in more detail. But does the idea of dimensional reduction make sense so far? Any questions? Okay, so a second class of task that you might look at is called generative modeling. So hopefully there'll be time that I can briefly tell you a little bit about some main ideas in generative modeling tomorrow. And then next week, we're going to have Mohammed, your TA, give a lecture about generative modeling. And actually, in the past, when we taught this course, we had more lectures on generative modeling and specific algorithms. And we actually found it was so much content that we're actually kind of separating most of it out. So there's actually going to be a one-week course in May, which is mainly targeted at PhD students, but you're all welcome to take it as well. It'll be May 8th to 12th. The details will be announced really soon. And there'll be a set of five lectures that go into more details on generative modeling there. So in this course that is happening right now, we're kind of just giving a quick introduction, but this is a really active and important field, so we want to kind of devote even more time to it outside of this course. But so tomorrow, and in Mohammed's lecture, we'll tell you a bit more. So today, I'll just give you one sentence on it so that you kind of have this complete picture of everything we'll see on unsupervised learning. So the idea is that we have our data points. And what we want to try to do is learn about the probability distribution that generated this data just from the selected finite amount of data that we have. And once we've learned about this probability distribution, we would also hope that we could generate new data samples from it. Okay. So that's all that I'm going to say about generative modeling for today, but we'll revisit that soon. And so now let me just kind of show you some more terminology or and relationship between supervised learning and unsupervised learning. Okay, so as I've told you, in unsupervised learning, kind of an overarching goal that we have is that we're given some data set, and what we want to do is take that data set and learn the probability distribution Px. And supervised learning, I can write as being given a set of data points with labels, and I can phrase the overall goal as learning a conditional probability distribution. Which is the probability of the label y given data point x. So this is what we're trying to do. So because of the chain rule of probabilities, it turns out that you can actually express an unsupervised learning problem in terms of several supervised learning problems. So if I consider the case where I'm trying to learn the distribution corresponding to coordinates x that have n components, then I can express this as a product like this. So I can kind of separate out this xn coordinate. And I can, of course, just continue to do this in a similar way. And I see that I can decompose this problem, or this probability, into a series of conditional distributions, plus the additional much simpler problem of learning the probability distribution of just one component. So in words, this means we can express an unsupervised learning problem as n minus 1 supervised learning problems. Plus the easier problem of learning the distribution of one component. So let's consider, let me kind of justify a case where this would be really easy to learn. Imagine that we're trying to learn something about the distribution of icing model spin configurations, or doesn't even have to be icing model. It could be anything that has a Z2 symmetry. Then, can anyone tell me, if I imagine my spin configurations have a symmetry so that on average they'll be half up and half down, Does anyone know what this Px1 would be? This would be, let me just translate. It's basically like on site one, the probability of finding up, for example.
Like 50%?
Yeah, exactly. So in some cases, we might not have to do anything to learn that distribution because it just might be something that we're assuming about our data, that it respects this kind of symmetry. So for example, in a lot of the data sets we're using, we would know that this one is just a half. And we can also go in the other direction. We can also express a supervised learning problem in terms of unsupervised learning problems. And let me write it here so I don't run out of space. We could also write like this. So we see that in both cases, there's a way to go from any supervised learning to a series of unsupervised learning problems and vice versa. So even though we think of these as two different class of algorithms, and we're still going to treat them as two quite separate algorithms in this course in terms of the algorithms we study, you see that there is a way to make connections between these different types of problems. Any questions, Linda? Okay, so now let's get a little more specific and we'll talk about dimensional reduction and specifically using a certain algorithm called PCA or principal component analysis. Okay, so the idea here, this is a certain class of dimensional reduction algorithm. So in any dimensional reduction algorithm, we're trying to generate a lower dimensional representation of our n-dimensional data points. In PCA, we specifically do this through a linear transformation. Okay, so for some data sets, this is going to be very helpful. In other cases, it won't be. So let me just draw for you a picture of a case where PCA would be helpful. So often I was saying, you know, we start with a very high dimensional data set, but just because I want to be able to actually draw this, let's say that we're starting just with two-dimensional data, and we're going to go down to one-dimensional data. So imagine I give you some data set that just has two components each. And imagine the data looks something like this. Well, you can imagine that it looks quite linear in this case. So x1 and x2 are very linearly correlated. This is supposed to be a straight line, sorry. So they're very linearly correlated. So knowing x1 is enough to infer x2 with high precision. And of course, maybe that's not always true. Maybe there are cases where these deviations from the linear behavior are actually really important and you need to study them. Then, of course, you wouldn't want to throw out that information. But you could imagine there might be tasks where just the fact that this is roughly linear is all you need to know. So just keeping one of those coordinates and the information about the transformation between the two would be enough for some tasks to represent your data. And let me also just say, which we'll kind of see throughout the course in explicitly in an example, of course, this is not always useful. There are definitely cases where we don't have any linear relationships between our components. And so right now we're studying a method that's based on something linear, and tomorrow we're going to talk about a more general method that doesn't rely on a linear transformation and is going to be able to apply to a wider array of data sets. Okay, but for this linear transformation, the way it's going to work, I'll just show you some notation. We're going to store all of our data points in a matrix. So remember that each one, sorry, I just rewrite this because I know it can get confusing what each component is. So we have m data points. And we're going to store these in an m by n matrix. So I'm going to call my matrix capital X. And I can think of that like this. So this is the matrix that I'll use for my calculations. And this is kind of a technical point, but in order to perform PCA, there's an assumption that the mean of your data points is zero. It's not accounting for a slope in the data. So the first step in this algorithm is actually to center the data. So for each column, we're going to perform a shift before we proceed any further. So That's going to look like this, or in matrix notation. And the C is just denoting this is now my centered data. So this is the first thing that I do, and just to remind you, my indices I go over my samples from 1 to m, and my j index goes from 1 to n over the components. Okay, so now let me introduce you to a new expression that's gonna kind of show us what we're actually looking for in PCA. So let's consider a matrix Vx. It has its n by n. So if I calculate this matrix here, then the diagonal components are going to store the variance of the components of my data set. And the off-diagonal elements store the covariances. Okay, and the reason that I introduced this quantity is because it will kind of enable me to restate the goal of PCA in a new way. So the goal of PCA, again, in this method, all we can do is apply something linear. So we want to find a new representation, which I'll call x prime. So that's just my centered data points multiplied by some constant factors. And what I would like is that this matrix of variances and covariances corresponding to this new data is diagonal. So that I don't have any covariance between my components in this new representation. Then this matrix P, it's n by n, and it's going to store what we call the principal components. So now we see that, of course, as I said, the kind of goal now is to find a representation so that this variance matrix for x prime is diagonal. And the way I can write that matrix. Is by looking at a product of the transpose of x prime times x, and then I can see that I can express this new matrix V, which I want to be diagonal, in terms of the old matrix, including then on either side the transpose and the untransposed P. And then when this matrix is diagonal, then I'm going to write this as this. So I just reduce this to an eigenvalue problem, which is all that we're going to have to solve in order to determine our principal components. And let me also just note that let me just note that this matrix V that you're trying to diagonalize is symmetric. We can find orthogonal eigenvectors. So then that's where we really see that we've reduced this to an eigenvalue problem, once we can show that this is actually symmetric. So this is actually the inverse here. I mean, feel free to ask any questions while I erase the board. Any questions so far? Okay. So just a few more points on PCA, and again, this is what we'll study in tomorrow's tutorial. So again, I can now write this as an eigenvalue problem in this way. And the notation that we'll use is that the eigenvalues are some lambda variables here. And we're going to assume, and what they each store is the variance of my new coordinates. And we can show all of those eigenvalues will be positive. We're also going to assume from here on out that we'll sort these eigenvalues. So that the biggest one is first, etc. That. Okay. So what does that mean, really? Can anyone think of what will it mean to look at, say, the first eigenvalue here that has the largest lambda? What does that really represent now? Yeah. And what does most important mean?
Like we'll have the most effect on. We don't necessarily need to know all of the rest of them. We just need to know the first
one. Yeah. And so it's going to have the biggest, I guess, differences in the data or the highest variance in this new representation. Yeah, perfect. So, now the first principal component, which is x1, after I've sorted it, this is going to correspond to the direction in space in this new representation with the highest variance. And the variance is this lambda 1. So one thing that we're going to look at in the tutorial is how this variance of these new components changes with the index. So of course, this is going to depend a lot on the data set that you have. But you might see something like this. That it kind of decays like this. You might also see cases where it doesn't decay so quickly like this. But if those lambdas quickly become small, then you expect that the lower dimensional representation might be quite good for your data. So, what this means is if we kind of kept the first few principal components and just discarded the rest, it might still be pretty good. So I'm saying if if this decay is fast enough, then we expect that, you know, cutting things off at the first few components is probably reasonable. It's still going to maintain a lot of the features that we want. And then, of course, it'll be more efficient because we're not storing n components. We're storing some smaller number. Of course, I'm not defining what I mean by quickly become small, because this is going to depend on the problem and what you're trying to do. So again, there could be cases where even small deviations from this linear behavior or anything non-zero is really important for what you're trying to do. So then, of course, this isn't going to make sense. But there might be cases where even throwing out things that are not exactly zero, because that's just some noise, that might be a useful thing to do. Okay, so just a little bit more terminology. Another thing that we're going to look at in the context of PCA in tomorrow's tutorial is something called the explained variance ratio. So this is basically a normalization of our lambda eigenvalues. And what you can think of this is, you think of it as basically how much of the variance that the data set has in total can be understood by the ith component. So the component xi prime is going to explain this fraction of the variance that you have in total. And another thing that we can talk about is the difference between signal and noise in this data. So we'll often say that the directions with large variance, so those are the first few principal components ideally. So if you have a case where they decay quickly enough, you would say that the first few components with the largest eigenvalues and therefore the largest variance, those correspond to signal. While others might correspond to noise. Okay, so let me just kind of attempt to draw for you what this could look like. Okay, so maybe I have some data that maybe looks kind of like a cloud like this. Then maybe I'll identify this as my x1 because it's the direction with largest variance. And this would be my x2. And I might think of this direction as the actual signal, and maybe in some cases the lower components might be considered noise in the data that you have. So this is just kind of to make sure this might be something that you've heard about before, these concepts, so I just wanted to show how that relates to this algorithm. Any questions about that? We have a few minutes still, so I'm just going to show you some pictures on the screen, if I can get the screen down. And feel free to ask any questions while I set that up. So let me show you what dimensional reduction can actually look like. I don't know why. Let me just give it a second. Okay, there we go. Okay, so you may remember that I think it was in the first lecture, I showed you a data set that's often studied in machine learning. We talked about it in the context of supervised learning, and that was the problem of recognizing handwritten digits. So what that problem was in supervised learning was that we would take images that people had drawn of the digits from 0 to 9, and the label would just be the label, the number that corresponds to that. But we can also study that in a dimensional reduction sense. So we won't tell it the label in this case and just feed in all of those pictures of handwritten digits. And so this is using an algorithm that we haven't studied yet, which it's called TSNE, and we're going to study that tomorrow. But just so you get the idea of what this can look like, here are some results that you can get using this more sophisticated TSNE algorithm on these. So if you look at the black data here, you'll see here, this has formed a cloud. It all looks like zeros. So they actually labeled the data with the actual picture here. This one is the twos, the ones. So the one cloud is pretty interesting here. You can see there's some that are not perfectly part of the cloud. There's some points that are kind of in between, but it's definitely making some clusters that seem to actually be separating out the digits as we would expect to be different. And so no labels are used to do that training, but kind of as a check of this method, they then colored the data points here with the correct label. So that's not used in training at all. It's just used to see how well the algorithm did. So you can see, for example, everything, most of the yellow is all in this cloud, but it's getting a few points wrong that these ones should ideally be in other clusters. But I'll also note that if you actually look at the pictures of what people drew, some people have pretty messy handwriting, so I don't know if I could even tell by eye sometimes what it was supposed to be. So Anyway, it's doing pretty well in this case. Okay, now I'm stuck. Okay, so now this is what this looks like using a couple of different algorithms. So this is again that same data set that I showed you on the previous slide. So on the left is using the PCA algorithm, which we just talked about, and then on the right is, and that's just using the first two principal components there because it's a two-dimensional representation there. And in the second one is using this TSNE algorithm, which we're going to talk about tomorrow. So you can see with the PCA, it's still, you know, separating out the clusters, or we have some colors grouped together, which is nice. But of course, if I didn't have colors here for this data set, you'd see you wouldn't really be able to distinguish the boundary between the clusters, whereas with the TSNE, you can see these nice boundaries separating out these clusters of data. So this is an example of a data set where probably the PCA is maybe not going to be good enough if you're trying to form these distinct clusters and really notice the distinct features in your data without having the colors. Okay, and then this is actually doing the same thing as on the first slide, this handwritten digits data set. It's the MNIST data set, but now it's actually in 3D, so they've made a movie at this site that I'm linking on the side. So now you can see what happens if you reduce to 3D, which should in principle keep more information because you're keeping three components instead of two. So now you can see, I didn't actually count them if there's 10 clusters or not, but again, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yeah, I think there's 10. So, okay. That's kind of fun. Okay, so now let's just talk quickly about what this means for the icing model. So you may remember that in supervised learning, what we've basically thought of so far is, in many cases, feeding in a spin configuration and then getting some label out, which tells us whether it's a paramagnetic or ferromagnetic state. So 0 means paramagnetic here, and 1 means ferromagnetic, and those are our labels. So just to kind of show you what it means to think about unsupervised learning for this same type of data set, but without labels, you can imagine that I give you this data set and I don't tell you anything about the labels, I don't tell you any examples of ferromagnetic, and I don't tell you any examples of paramagnetic. So you have a bit less information here, but you still might imagine that if you were given this data set and you knew nothing about physics, you knew nothing about the icing model, you still maybe might be able to say by eye that this set of data maybe belongs to some group one. You, of course, wouldn't be able to say it's called paramagnetic, but you might be able to say that these ones look fairly similar. And if you succeeded at really differentiating ferromagnetic and paramagnetic, it would mean you would say that all of these blue data points are in the same group. But I would guess that if I asked you to do this by eye, you might actually give me three groups. You would probably say that the mostly black are in group 2 and the mostly white are in group 3. So even though we only have a paramagnetic and ferromagnetic phase, because we have this symmetry breaking and the spin configurations can look so different in spin up or spin down, this algorithm in this case, we would probably expect that it's going to tell us there are three different groups of data rather than two. Does that make sense? Okay. So let me just show you what that looks like when you do dimensional reduction, and you guys are going to reproduce some of these results in the tutorial and the homework. So for the icing model, the two-dimensional icing model using PCA, this is what we'll do in tutorial tomorrow. You can study different sizes of lattices, so it's a L by L icing model. So if you look at L equals 20, it's somewhat similar to what we saw for those handwritten digits, that if I color by temperature, which is done here, so the higher temperatures are red, the lower temperatures are blue, You can see that it is separating. The red is more in the middle, the blue is on the outside, but I'm not getting distinct clusters. So if I didn't have that knowledge of the temperature, I might not be able to look at that top cluster and say that there are distinct phases in this data. But if you go up to, say, L equals 80, you can see that these more distinct clusters kind of start to form. Of course, there's still a lot in the middle, but you're doing a little bit better here. And again, just to emphasize, because it's really important, that although we color by temperature, it's not used in the algorithm. It's just used to check how well we're doing at the end. And all you're given is just the spin configurations into that PCA algorithm. Do you guys have questions about these plots? We'll talk a lot more about them during tomorrow's tutorial, but any questions for now? Okay, so then let me just, I forgot to show this, that again, what we would know after labeling the temperatures and with the knowledge that we have is that it turns out that this algorithm is grouping the paramagnetic phase and then the two ferromagnetic phases. So on one side is the one with positive spins and the other one is with negative spins, or spin up and spin down. And now let me just show you, which is something you're going to look at in the homework, is what happens when you use this more sophisticated algorithm, which is not just linear. So I haven't shown you this algorithm yet. I'm going to talk about it tomorrow. But in this case, you can see you're going to get an even more distinct separation between these different clusters. And again, in this case, the two blue clusters are the ferromagnetic clusters, one with spin up, one with spin down, and the red one is paramagnetic. It tends to do a little bit better. And I think this is also for a smaller lattice size as well. So both algorithms kind of work in this case, but we do see that we get kind of different results with this algorithm, which we'll dive into more tomorrow. do you guys have any questions? Okay, so see you tomorrow, and just let me know if you have any questions about the homework that's due tomorrow. This one is not on the homework that's currently out. I'll give that to you after the deadline of the first homework. Okay, thanks, guys.